for anybody. I'm Janet. I'm an alcoholic. And glad to be here. I was not in a very sober frame of mind on my way here tonight, so I know I'm in the right place. I'm always glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never say no when something is asked of me, because I have a big debt to give back, to pay back to this program, because I have a lot of really beautiful blessings in my life today, and I wouldn't have any of them if I was still out there. And I can only thank the program for that. I always start my talk the same way. I hope I say something that you can relate to tonight. If I don't, please keep going to meetings. I promise you'll hear your story. If you go to enough meetings, someone will tell your story. My last drink was 2nd of May of 1993, and my first meeting was 3rd of May, and it's been quite a journey. Never a dull moment. And it started a long time ago. This program affected my life before I was a member of it, because my dad is a longtime member. A lot of my family members are, but my childhood and my life would have been very, very different if my dad hadn't been coming to these rooms when I was born. So I had my footprint in here before I needed to come here, but I knew where to come. I'm the youngest of three, and I think that was my first resentment. I didn't like that. I didn't like being the youngest. Like so many of my resentments, it was something completely beyond my control. As most of my resentments are, it's about things that I can't control or can't have my way about. You can't change your position in your family. And there was quite a big age difference between my sisters and I. So I always felt like it was them and then me. And they didn't have to do anything to make me feel that way. I just felt that way. And that's the thing about this illness, is that nobody has to do or say anything to make me feel a certain way. The way I perceive things is usually a little bit skewed. And I think that's the crux of this illness for me. What you said wasn't necessarily what I heard, and what you did wasn't necessarily what I saw. And I believe that I was born an alcoholic. And the ism part of alcoholism affected my life before the alcohol ever did, because it made me think differently and it made me feel things differently. And it made me live in my head a lot. I overthought everything all the time. And I think I found different ways of escape before I had my first glass of wine. I used to read a lot as a kid. I lived in books. That was a big escape for me. I used to write. I used to imagine things. And I was never happy with the status quo. I always wanted to be somewhere else, doing something else with someone else, looking a different way, no matter where I was. And that's a pretty exhausting way to be. I grew up in a really nice family. Born and raised here in Montreal, I grew up in Laval. And if you were on the outside looking in, you'd say, this kid had nothing to complain about. You know, I had a nice family. My parents were really good to me. My sisters were good to me. I went to school. I was a normal kid. But in here, everything was always going 1,000 miles a minute. It is a disease that affected me mentally, spiritually, emotionally, and eventually physically. But going through school, I had to excel. I had to excel because I always felt that I was starting 3 feet under the bar. So steering myself even near the bar, I had to outdo everybody else. I compared myself to everybody else. That's a losing proposition because I never measured up. Everybody had to like me. I had to have everybody's approval. I had to have teachers' approval. I had to have peers' approval, parents' friends' approval. Even if I didn't like you, you had to like me because I was a nice person, you know? And I had to do everything to prove to you that I was a likable person. And when you're going through school and you're feeling not quite up to par, and you read a lot and you're quiet and you're a teacher's pet and you do well all the time. And the other thing that really marked my childhood was that I hated confrontation of any kind. I'm not too keen on it as an adult, but I'm aware that it's a fact of life. But when you go through life that way, when you go through school that way with all those things and not liking confrontation, you're going to get picked on. And I did. I got picked on a lot because I never fought back. And I was the teacher's pet, and I read all the time. And I had my group of friends, but the bullies were on the bus. And I used to throw up every day before I had to get on the bus. And it took me a long time to find my voice. Even as an adult, it took me a long time to find my voice in confrontations, even if it was somebody else's. If it was the people next to me having an argument, my palms would sweat, and my stomach would go into knots. And I had to make everything okay all the time, you know. Everything had to be okay all the time. And I used to listen to people's tone of voice, and I used to watch people's expression on their face, and I used to think, what did that tone mean, or what did that look mean, or, you know, I just analyzed everything to death. And I haven't even gotten to high school yet, you know, and that's, you know, I worried, that was the other thing too, I worried all the time. I played the what-if games. What if this happens? What if that happens, you know? Never lived in the moment. And it took me a long time to learn to live in the moment. And I don't do it perfectly. When I was 14, both my sisters moved out. And I was going to high school and everything was very dramatic and everything seemed very traumatic. In retrospect, it wasn't all that bad. And it coincided with my first drink. And I was drunk from my first drink. And I wasn't the type of adolescent who said, ugh, that tasted bad and it made me sick. I don't want to do that again. My experience was that tasted great. It made me sick, but I really want to do it again. Because I was in Ottawa visiting a cousin, and we went out with some of his friends who were older, and they ordered wine with dinner. And I started having some of this wine, and for the very first time after that first glass of wine, everything inside of me just went, and it was like my brain switched off, and I wasn't worried for the first time about what I was saying or what I looked like or measuring up or what they thought of. And I just focused on the wine, you know, and I can't tell you what I had to eat. I can't tell you anything else about that night, but I had a lot of wine. And it was fabulous. It was absolute freedom. It was the ultimate escape. And for the next 7 years, I chased that particular feeling, and it was never quite that good again. It stayed good for a while, but it never quite shut off the switch as thoroughly as it did that night. And I got sick, and I wasn't even embarrassed. You know, for a person who cared so much about what other people thought, the fact that I had to run down the alley and, you know, regurgitate all the wine, I didn't even care about that, you know. And I came home. And that feeling stayed with me, and I just thought, how am I going to get some more of that? And I had limited access to it when I was in high school. I could get it when I could, and I did. So I drank on and off through high school, and when I got to CJEP, my drinking took off, and I just drank my way through CJEP. I drank with impunity for a long time. I didn't have any real consequences. Because I had always been a good kid, so nobody was looking for me to get into trouble. And I manipulated absolutely every situation to make sure that I still looked good, but I was high as a kite for all the way to CJEP. I still got good grades, but all the things that go with alcoholic drinking began immediately. Lying, stealing, cheating, manipulating. I was a sneaky kid, and that stayed with me, and I stayed one step ahead of everything to make sure that I could get my drink and I could have a great time, and no one knew the extent of what I was doing. And that became my focus then. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and I was finally one of the cool kids. And when you've never been one of the cool kids, that's not an easy thing to give up. And I never got my license in that time frame. Never wanted to be the designated driver. I had nice friends who took care of me. I had patient friends because I'm sure that I wasn't always quite the life of the party that I remember myself to be. And I was a wanderer when I was drunk. I always wanted to go off and go for a walk and go explore, and people had to pull me back all the time. But it was fun, and I came out of my shell and drank all the way through, and I had more freedom and more money and more access to it, and we were in bars underage, and I don't have to explain the whole process. CDEP ended, and everyone was getting ready to go to university, and I wasn't ready to buckle down yet. Things at home had deteriorated quite a bit. I was not getting along with my parents. I was not getting along with my dad in particular. And as a credit to his program and his sobriety, he let me go and do my thing. It must have been really hard for him to watch his daughter go through that. He was the only one that I wasn't fooling, because you can't con, and I hated the fact that I could not lie to him, that I could not get it past him. And he knew when I was hungover, because I'd get the eyeglasses over the newspaper saying, "You're going to work anyway." No sympathy. but we weren't a big yelling, screaming type of family. We were a shut down when you're angry type of family, so we had a lot of silent fights, which I think is even more stressful. And my mom was in the middle. And it was all about me. It was all about me. I was the youngest. I was spoiled. I had a huge sense of entitlement. And I thought that nobody understood me. Nobody got me. My resentment for my sisters got worse because they had left me with these two people who just didn't get it. And they were off leading their own lives. And I applied for jobs at West. I didn't tell anyone that I was doing it. And I got hired. And they said, "You have to be here next week." So in a very selfish and cold way, I just said, "By the way, I'm moving to Alberta." And I had quit my job and I had bought my ticket. And I didn't give anyone a chance to absorb it, grasp it, say goodbye, nothing. I was on the plane and, you know, screw all of you, I'm going. And I went 3,000 miles away. I didn't know a soul. I had a job waiting for me, but that was about it. And I listed it as this big adventure, you know. I was just 19, I think. And I got out there, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I had no sense of responsibility. I had no sense of accountability. It was just one big party. And I got out there, and I found the drinkers. And I was working at a resort as a chambermaid. You know, it was a brainless job. It was easy to do drunk. It was easy to do hungover. My rent came off my paycheck, and I lived on the property. So I still had no real sense of what paying rent was or paying groceries. And I thought in my head that I was this big grown-up making it on my own. And I was sharing a tiny room with three other girls who drank as much as I did. I mean, I wasn't exactly at the top of my game. And my standards and my expectations for myself just kept getting lower. And I was cleaning these rooms. And it was a beautiful place. People spent a lot of money to stay there. And I didn't care about any of that, you know. And I would show up reeking of the night before. And I would steal from the amenities carts that I had. I would take the mouthwash, and I would take the shampoo, and I would take the toothbrushes, and I would put myself together slowly as the day went on. And I would, you know, nap in the beds before I made them, and I would, you know, use the shower sometimes. Like, I just didn't care. It was awful. And I never got caught. I timed it so that my supervisor saw me at the end of the day when I was working half decent. And I just did that. And I just went on. And I went to work, and I went out at night. And I went to work, and I went out at night. But I was starting to have consequences for my drinking that I had never had before. And people didn't find me quite as amusing as my friends at home did. And I went through a lot of roommates, and I went through a lot of boyfriends, and I went through a lot of friends, and I wore out my welcome really fast because I stole from everyone. I lied to everyone about everything. I didn't respect other people's property. I didn't respect other people's relationships. I was not a very nice person. And the bitch of it was that I still needed everyone's approval. And I still needed everyone to think that I was a nice person because I knew inside that this wasn't really me. And I couldn't explain to them that this wasn't really me. You know, yes, I stole the last of the money, or yes, you know, I did this or that, but I'm still a nice person. And I couldn't reconcile that with anybody. And my job was on the line. I had a boss that I think felt bad for me. And everything was just rapidly coming unraveled. And my sister called and said that she was coming out to visit. And I didn't want her to come. And then I didn't want her to go. I was still not happy with the status quo. Before she came, I had to go around and do preemptive strikes everywhere. I had to hide my whole life from her. Don't tell her I smoke. Don't tell her I do this. Don't tell her don't have my drink on the bar when we come in. Like, my life was secret after secret after secret after secret. And lie after lie after lie. And I couldn't remember who I had told what to anymore. I couldn't keep it straight. And my sister came out, and I hid everything from her. And I would pack her back up into her room at night, and then I would go back and drink the way I wanted to. And she went home, and I came home a few months after that for a visit. And my parents tried to get me to stay, and I said no. And I went back out, and I hit my bottom when I got back out there. And I had experimented with drugs. Alcohol was still my first love. I had done a few things, but I found it very easy to take pills when I was drinking. And I mixed a whole bunch of pills one night with my wine. And it took a lot more to get the job done. By this time, I was drinking by myself. I had completely isolated myself from everybody. I still needed the liquor, but not the party. And people would knock on my door, and I would open it this much, and what do you want? You're interrupting me, you know? If I wasn't at work, I was drunk. And half the time when I was at work, I was drunk. And I went into a depression, and it sort of scared me because by nature, I'm a pretty happy person. And nothing that I could do made me feel better. Not getting drunk, not anything. And I had lost my ability to talk to people. I couldn't communicate with anybody. And I couldn't read anymore. I couldn't get through a magazine article, much less a novel. And I started to have physical consequences to my drinking and mental anguish that I cannot explain. And anyway, I took all this stuff one night. My roommate was gone, and I had stockpiled it all and planned it. And I didn't want to kill myself, I don't think. I just wanted a break. And I wanted to wake up and have things be different. And I woke up 2 days later, and nothing was different. Somebody finally noticed that I was gone and came looking for me. And they said, why don't you go down and see the counselor? There was a staff counselor for EAP type of thing. And I went down, and we danced around everything but the real issue. And I told her about how awful my boss was and how awful my boyfriend was and how impossible it was still for my roommates and the whole song and dance. And she knew what I wasn't saying, and I knew what I wasn't saying. And she said, just come back when you're ready. And I went out one night, and it had come to the point where I was saying to my roommate, make sure I leave with you. And it didn't occur to me that normal people didn't have to do this. And this roommate and I were on again, off again in our friendship because I had stolen her car one night. And I still didn't have a license. And I was trying to impress someone, and it became evident very quickly that I did not have my license. And I got caught because when I went to park the car again, someone had taken the spot, and I had to park it in a different spot, and she knew that it was me. And I denied everything. As soon as I got caught with anything, I denied it. You know, even if it was written across my forehead, I would still deny it. And she said, okay. And we went out, and we had a few, and she said, okay, I'm done. I'm going back. And I said, okay, bye. And she said, don't you want to come? And I said, no. And I kept drinking, and I had been a blackout drinker for a long time. And it had gotten to the point where I would say to people, don't fill in the blanks for me. You know, whatever it is, I'm sorry. I gave blanket apologies, and I didn't want to know the last hours or days. And I started the night in one town, and I woke up the next day, and I was in another town. And this was a big blackout. It had never been that extreme before. And I woke up, and I felt about that big. And I didn't know where I was. I didn't know how I'd gotten there. I didn't know who this person was, whose apartment it was. And it was just very surreal. And it scared me into coherence. And I was late for work, and I thought, okay, I'm fired. I have no money to go home. I have no money for a plane ticket. I haven't put my feet on the floor yet, and I've jumped into next week in my head. That's the way my brain still works. And I just said, take me back. And we went back, and I basically had a breakdown in the boss's office. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't want my life to be like this anymore. I just don't. And for some reason, I thought of AA. And I had known about AA from the family. And I looked it up in the phone book, and I called, and he was great. He said, take a few days, clean yourself up, go to the meeting. And I went home and I slept it off, and I woke up and I immediately remembered that I had called and immediately regretted it. Didn't want to go at all. But I had enough respect for this man that I said, you know what, I told him I would go and I'll go. And I went, and it was a really small meeting. There were about six or eight people there, and they went around the table and they all did step one for me. And I cried for the whole meeting because I could relate to something that everybody said, and I didn't want to. Part of it was comforting, and part of it was horrifying, because with every fiber of my being, I did not want to be an alcoholic. And I just kept saying, I'm too young. I'm too young. You know, everybody does this. And they're like, yeah, but not everybody does this and this and this. And they said, you know what, just come back next week. And I did. And I started my journey. I didn't have a drink from that day on, but for the first 2 years of this journey, I cannot take credit for being sober. I was dry at best. And if you're new, I wouldn't recommend doing it the way I did it, because I made it as hard as possible on myself. I basically went to meetings, and that was it. I didn't do any service. I didn't change people, places, or things in my life. I got a sponsor who I never called. I did the bare minimum. I still went to the bar every night, and I brought my big book to the bar. And the stories with the bartender. And I even started the book at the end. I didn't even read what the program was in the book. It was very, very difficult. And I white-knuckled it. I committed the cardinal sin very soon in, and I got involved with someone. And I found someone that I could fix, because if I was fixing him, I wasn't looking at me. And I brought him home for Christmas, and it was a disaster. It was a unanimous thumbs down from everybody in my family. So I went back out and said, I'm going to marry him. And I moved in with him. And when I saw what our life would really be like, I said no. I believe that when the pain is greater than the fear, we will take action. And I had to have my back right up against the wall before I did anything. So all I did basically was not drink, but I didn't get sober. And if I had been mentally and spiritually and physically and emotionally drunk, I had to be all those things in sobriety. And I finally came home alone, left everything. I just left my life out there. And I came home and I started to get serious about my sobriety. And I met a lady and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, we'll try it on a temporary basis. And that was 10 years ago and she's still my sponsor. And I started doing the steps. Imagine that, there are steps to this thing, you know. And I finally admitted that I was an alcoholic and I didn't want to take it back. And I was okay with that, you know. And she said, okay, good. You've admitted that you're an alcoholic. Now bring God into it. And I didn't have a problem with that. I didn't have any problem with God. You didn't have to sell God to me. What I had to do was I had to change the God that I talked to, because if I was going to have someone that I talked to every day, it couldn't be the same God at 20 that I had had at 10, because I was afraid of him. So that's what I had to work on. I had to work on how I looked at this God. And I had to look at him as my friend. And she pointed out to me, she said, you know what? You're turning your life and your will over to his care. Over to his care, not over to his complete, you know, control. And that, I took comfort in that, that he cared about me. And when I could do that, and I could start turning things over, it took some of the pressure off, because I didn't have to control everything, and I didn't have to make everything perfect. And I would turn it over and take it back, and turn it over and take it back, and turn it over with stipulations. Okay, I'll give it to you, but make it go this way, you know? And I finally changed even how I did that over the years. And then she said, okay, you got to look at what brought you here, because you came in here with a lot of garbage and a lot of secrets and a lot of everything that's negative. And she said, it's going to keep you sick and it's going to keep you slow from growing, so you got to get rid of it. And I wrote everything down, and for the first time in my life, I was completely gut-wrenchingly honest with another human being. And I told her everything that I was the most ashamed of. And she didn't take me out of her house, and this guy didn't fall. And it was liberating. It was very, very scary, but very liberating. And 4 and 5 were done. And she said, now you can keep growing, you know. And I've done subsequent 4 and 5s over the years. But the first one was, I'll never forget it. And 6 and 7 for a long time were the non-steps to me. 4 and 5 showed me who I was, because I had never known that. I was always who you wanted me to be. And 6 and 7 were like, okay, I found out that I'm judgmental and impatient and all this kind of stuff. And I'm ready to have them gone, sure, so take them. And I'd wake up the next day and I'd still have them. And you know, I went on like that for a long time, and they weren't really action steps the way everything else had been. It was sort of like throwing them out to the abyss, you know. And that it was like a boomerang; they kept coming back. And I finally learned that he won't take them all away. My higher power will not take away all my defects. He see will lessen them to a degree in my life that they won't kill me. But they are my biggest learning tools today, because through impatience I learn patience, and through intolerance I learn tolerance, and through being a procrastinator I learn to get off my butt and do things quicker. You know, he took away the big ones, but all the other stuff I'll never completely be free of, because I have to learn from that, and that's a big part of my humility, I think. 8 and 9, I seriously thought, in all honesty, that they did not apply to me when I first got here, because I had done all my drinking out there. All the worst of it happened out there. They were 3,000 miles away. I was never going to see them again. You know, moving on. And my sponsor said, no. You have to be willing to make amends for what happened out there. And if those people are put in your path at some point, you can. But she said, you still hurt people here. Through your attitude, you hurt them. All of that selfishness and sense of entitlement and being ungrateful to my family that I had talked about earlier, I did have amends to make. And for all of my resentments against their sister, my sisters, they had some of their own. You know, I wasn't exactly a peach to live with. Shocking as that was for me to find out. And I did, and I made amends, you know. And I have a real relationship with my family today, not a surface one, because I can be me, the real me, and they can be themselves. And not everything is superficial, especially between my father and I now. And that's a big gift of sobriety for me. 10, 11, and 12 were, I try to live in today. I don't do it perfectly every day. I'm privileged and lucky and blessed to be married to a member, so we can do it 10th together. And, you know, you just basically go over your day. Did anything make you mad today? Were you scared of anything? You know, were you impatient? Were you dishonest? The four major questions. But I don't have to be that formal about it, because I know in here that if there's something that's going to wake me up at 2 in the morning, I better take care of it before I go to bed. You know, and I try to do that. I try to clean my slate every night if it needs to be erased. 11, I'm not a meditator. My brain still moves too quickly for that. I can't empty it or turn it off. But I can take quiet moments, and I like the saying that when I'm praying, I'm talking to God, and when I'm meditating, He's talking to me. And I throw a lot of stuff up to Him, and I have to give Him time to answer sometimes. And I have to look for the answers and take them as I get them. You know, not I don't wait to get the answer that I want now, which is what I used to do. I used to pick and choose who I would talk to get the answer that I wanted. And now I take it as it comes. And 12, this is one of the ways that I do 12. I never say no when I'm asked to speak. I got really busy in service over the last 12 years. I've done just about every job in a group. I got a home group. I joined the Public Information Committee, which is really fun because I get to go to high schools now and talk to kids. And that ties in well with my career. I got a chance to go back to school, and I work with kids in trouble now, and that's, I just love it. And my life is very, very, very different from when I first came in. I have a sense of peace today that I never had. Some days stronger than others, but I never have the anguish that I came in with again. I got married. I'm going to be a mommy. I went back to school. Just so many good things. And I have friends and family now who can trust me. And I can live a life of integrity today. And that's a big, big blessing. And it's not perfect. Nobody promised me that if I put the wine down, everything would be perfect. But nothing drives me back to the bar now. And the meetings do for me what the alcohol used to do. So if you're new, get a sponsor that you call and don't bring your big book to the bar. And just take it one day at a time, and I hope you have a great 24 hours, and I thank you for my sobriety.
Thanks, Janet. On behalf of the group, I'd ask Karen to thank you.
Hi, Karen.
I want to thank you for sharing it, and I spent the whole morning honestly quietly. One of the things I really liked was the way she talked about going through the steps, because a lot of times I hear people talk about doing them, working and living them, and I'm sitting there going, but how do you do that, you know? And you have a really good explanation of how it works for you. I want to thank you on behalf of this panel.
Thank you.
Okay, there's no chips or cakes that I know of tonight, so I'm going to ask Grant to give us the desire chip now.
Hi everyone, my name is Grant, I'm in the hall.
You're a great chair, thank you, Janet.
Janet talked about the steps. One of the first steps that I was told when I first walked into these rooms was to admit that we had a problem with alcohol. And navigating your way around these rooms sometimes can be confusing. There's a lot of people, we've got our own little saying in here, and it might be confusing for somebody that first walks in. So one of the best ways to help us identify, and help you, and this is how the program works, is to come up and take one of these. It's the beginner's tip. Is there anyone that
would
like to take it?
I'm not much of a beginner, but I say to myself, as long as I have a tongue and I can talk, as long as I have any meanings and I cannot drink, because